This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Coming up, make sure your seat is comfy. Tom Stoppard's new play is 9.5 hours long. But first, I have to ask, since we have you in the studio, do people ever come up to you and say, oh, come on, just give me a little money. You won't miss it.
They do sometimes, not very often.
We are joined in the studio by David Rockefeller. Mr. Rockefeller has just done something that is rare for a member of this most prominent and powerful American family. He has written a candid, if exquisitely well-mannered, autobiography of a life that has stretched from the first years of the 20th century into the 21st, from his father, John D. Rockefeller, Jr., to Fidel Castro, from Anwar Sadat to Saddam Hussein, and from Henry Kissinger to Nelson Mandela. Mr. Rockefeller's book is called David Rockefeller Memoirs. Thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be. Thank you so much for having me.
Casting back on it, when did you begin to learn that people would just hear your name and judge you?
Certainly by the time I was in high school, maybe even before. Mm-hmm. It sometimes was a nuisance, but I was rather overweight at the time. I think I was more upset by their calling me fatty sometimes than I was by their referring to the family's name.
I guess we concentrate so much, just when we hear the name Rockefeller, on the potential advantages. It wasn't until I cracked open the book that I was reminded of the fact that you are the grandson of someone you acknowledge to be one of the most hated men in the world of his time. That can't be easy.
No, that's true, but by the time I came along, I think that hatred had largely evaporated. Mm-hmm. There was a woman named Ida Tarbell who was very bitter about grandfather and wrote an unfriendly book. Mm-hmm. But I think that more and more people had come to realize that in bringing order out of chaos in the oil industry was a very important thing for the country. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, he really was, in many respects, along with Andrew Carnegie, the father of philanthropy in this country.
Some family questions, if I could first.
Sure.
Your father gave out dimes to people on the street?
My grandfather. Yes, he did, which I think seemed strange in many ways to some people. But I think the reason was a very simple one. The fact that he had great wealth and there was a lot written about him meant that he was rather isolated in many ways from people in general. By giving out shiny dimes, which he did when he met people on the street or when he went to church or whatnot, it gave him an excuse to meet them and exchange a few words with them. And he felt, I think, this was something he enjoyed.
You bear the name and are so identified with your father's family, but as a human being, do you feel that you might carry more the imprint of your mother?
I adored my mother. She was a very remarkable person. And, of course, her own family was a pretty distinguished one. Her father was Senator Nelson W. Aldrich, and he was the majority whip of the United States Senate for 33 years. So she did have an interest in politics and the world in a way that was different from father. But in addition to that, she was very interested in the arts, and she played a role, an important role, in with two other ladies in starting the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
I just wonder, just at a personal level, when you laugh, do you hear your mother's voice or your father's?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I've ever been asked, and I'm not certain that I know the answer. Probably mother's.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about your brother, Nelson. Early on, you talk about family photographs and the way in which your brother, Nelson, although not the eldest, would seem to just naturally put himself in the center of any family picture with that magnificent smile so many people remember. You loved your brother Nelson, didn't always like him. Would that be fair to say?
I loved and admired him, and that continued throughout his life. I think that at certain points during his political career, and to a degree when he was divorced and remarried, there were some tensions between us. But on balance, I look back upon him as a really great American citizen, and I think he would have been a good president.
You write in the book, too, that after his political career was over, you had the impression that he tried to install himself as the head of the family, and that that was resented.
I think that it is certainly true that the breakup of his marriage and all the things that went along with it meant that his commanding position as leader of the family was eroded.
I'm just struck by the scene in the book where you talk about the brothers sending memos back and forth through the halls of in your various family signatures in Rockefeller Center, and you guys were unsparing with each other at one point.
I guess that happened a few times, and perhaps in moments when feelings were fairly deep and felt that it would be better to express things in writing, but it wasn't something that went on as a general rule.
How did you come to debate Nikita Khrushchev? You and your daughter, Neva.
I was going on a trip to the Soviet Union.
This was 64, 65?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I got word that Mr. Khrushchev would like to see us in Moscow. My family's name in Russia at that time was very well known, and they've ascribed to the family powers that we certainly did not have. Mm-hmm. So I think he felt he was talking with someone who he thought was more powerful than in fact was the case.
I got the impression that he rather thought you ran the country.
I think he did.
Can you help us appreciate what it was like to be in his presence? I mean, so many Americans at that point knew the guy who banged his shoe on the desk at the United Nations.
Well, he was a little that way, and as I think I may say in the book, at one point he did bang on the table to Neva and say, "One day you will think the way we do."
The two of you had a respect for each other that I wasn't quite expecting.
It was quite fascinating. We went at one another with strong views, each on our own side. Yet throughout, I think we did respect one another, and it was never a hostile debate.
Another thing that struck me in the conversation, when he turned to your daughter and said, "One day she will agree with me," in fact, in the bosom of your family, you have had a couple of youngsters who've become socialists, radicals. How does that work out in your family?
Well, I think that they've all been associated with people who had different ideas. They read things. They are people who are very concerned about humanity and the role that the United States should play. And I think particularly back in the 60s, I think it's very much less true today, they had a different view of how the United States should be run and what philosophy we should adopt.
To put a specific point on it, your daughter Abby became a member of the Socialist Workers' Party.
I guess she did. My impression is it didn't last very long and never was a very serious thing, but she did feel very deeply and she still has different views than mine on many subjects, but she's a very devoted daughter, and we have wonderful times together, and that hasn't interfered with our loving relationship.
When you read about today's corporate scandals, does that give capitalism a bad name?
Yes. I think it's shocking. And the capitalist system, if people act honorably and well, has proven to be one that benefits the population as a whole. Mm-hmm. But when people take advantage of it, obviously they're discrediting the whole system, and I don't think that they should be allowed to get away with it.
Mm-hmm. And while we have you in the studio, do you think the people who are getting really rich in the United States today, have they lived up to their obligation to spread their wealth around, to re-energize philanthropy?
Bill Gates, I think, is a good example of one more riches than anyone else in certainly our times and maybe ever. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is that he has shown great responsibility. I think there have been other cases when they haven't. And in a few cases that I can think of, a couple of people that I knew and are no longer alive, they didn't, and they spent their money supposedly for self-gratification, and they ended up very unhappy people.
Mm-hmm. Because self-gratification in the end isn't really gratifying?
It's nice to live well and eat well and own things, but there comes a time if you have enough money when you just can't enjoy them all. And there are other things which I think can bring one much greater satisfaction, and that's doing things for others.
Mr. Rockefeller, nice talking to you.
I enjoyed it. Thanks very much.
David Rockefeller is the author of David Rockefeller, Memoirs.